American people. Well, water is one of those things. It's a necessity of life.
Did Iran hack water systems in at least 7 U.S. states? State officials are reporting the water supply is safe for now.
Another front in the war with Iran this Thursday, August 6th on All Things Considered.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Ilse Chang. Ahead this hour, an update on the ICE operation known as Country Roads after the John Denver song.
It's insulting because Country Roads song is a welcoming song. It's the place I belong. And they're kicking people out.
Plus, new research on how mountain lions could make roads safer for us humans.
And newsflash from space. Scientists are watching a wandering supermassive black hole.
We started to find them in the centers of galaxies. And what we did was we trained the AI algorithm to recognize this very characteristic pattern of light.
First, the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. The Iranian parliament is reviewing an agreement between Iran and Oman to reopen the Strait of Hormuz. Oman sits on the southern side of the critical waterway that's been blockaded by Iran since the U.S. and Israel began their war in February. NPR's Hadil Al-Shalchi has more.
Iranian state media said that the agreement between Iran and Oman bans any U.S. or Israeli ships from moving through the Strait of Hormuz and that Iran will charge a fee of up to 7% of the value of a ship's cargo and impose a fine of up to 20% of that value if these conditions are broken. It said that ships will enter the Strait of Hormuz through the northern corridor of the strait near the Iranian coast and they will exit through the southern corridor near the Omani coast. The U.S. has been strongly opposed to any fees imposed on ships moving through the strait. The White House is yet to officially comment on the agreement. Hadil Al-Shalchi, NPR News, Istanbul.
President Trump's plans for the U.S. Navy to build new nuclear-powered battleships will take longer and cost a lot more than initially thought. That's the finding of a new report from the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office, as NPR's Kat Lonsdorf reports.
Trump announced the plan for the Navy to build its largest battleship since World War II back in December, saying they would be, quote, the fastest, the biggest, and by far 100 times more powerful than any battleship ever built. They've been dubbed Trump-class battleships. The first was initially said to cost around $15 billion, but the estimate by the CBO found it will likely cost more than $23 billion. 14 additional ships are also estimated at substantially more than originally thought, with a total price tag of $275 billion for the whole fleet. U.S. shipyards also may not have the capacity to build such ships, the report found, saying the first might take 8 years or longer to build. Trump had originally said at least two would be finished by the end of his term. Kat Lonsdorf, NPR News, Washington.
The Food and Drug Administration has approved the first flu vaccine that uses the same mRNA technology as COVID-19 vaccines. NPR's Rob Stein has more.
The vaccine is called Mflusiva. It was developed by Moderna, the same company that produced one of the two mRNA COVID shots. Research indicates Mflusiva may be more protective than traditional flu shots. It can also be updated to adapt to new strains and produced much more quickly. The fate of the mRNA flu shot had been in doubt because of the Trump administration's hostility towards mRNA vaccines in the wake of the pandemic. In fact, the FDA initially refused to even consider the vaccine. Moderna says the new shot can now be available for the upcoming flu season. Rob Stein, NPR News.
Wall Street lower by the closing bell. You're listening to NPR News from Washington. Republican Senator Mitch McConnell says in a statement that he's been discharged from a rehab hospital and will continue his recovery from a fall in June at home. The 84-year-old didn't provide a timeline on when he would return to the Senate, but some question his fitness to remain in office after McConnell hasn't been seen since the accident. That prompted calls for transparency from many, including Kentucky's Democratic Governor Andy Beshear. A new study in Ethiopia looked at whether a combination of cash transfers and mental health counseling could help people in poverty build longer-lasting stability. NPR's Fatma Taunus has more.
Economists are looking for ways to break what they call the poverty mental health vicious cycle. That's when poor mental health can impair a person's decision-making and productivity, and the stresses of poverty pile on. In 2022, researchers tested an intervention in ultra-poor villages in Ethiopia. Some households received group therapy. Others received cash in the amount of $279. A third group received both the cash and the therapy. Years later, researchers found that the therapy alone had virtually no impact. The cash had helped people grow income, and the combination of cash and therapy had a slight edge on income growth. The program was funded by USAID, which has since been dismantled by the Trump administration. Fatma Tanis, NPR News.
On Wall Street at the close, the Dow was down 464 points, the Nasdaq down 15, S&P 500 down 13. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. RWJF is a national philanthropy working toward a future where health is no longer a privilege, but a right. Learn more at rwjf.org.
6 minutes after 4 o'clock. Thank you for listening to KAXE and All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. Support comes from Timberlake Restaurant in Grand Rapids, featuring PK Mayo, Monday, August 10th, as part of the Martini Monday Music Series from 5 to 8. Reservations at 218-326-2600. Mostly clear tonight, lows 59 to 63, and tomorrow sunny, highs in the mid to upper 70s. Saturday should be sunny as well, with highs in the mid 70s to low 80s.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly in Washington. An agreement to reopen the Strait of Hormuz could be close to being sealed. Iran's parliament is reviewing the proposal to reopen the waterway. And key point here, the deal is between Iran and Oman. It would not directly involve the United States. We don't know yet what that could mean for the U.S. or for global oil markets. Meanwhile, the broader conflict continues. Over the next few minutes, we're going to hear about what could be a new front, cyber attacks. I spoke about that today with NPR cybersecurity correspondent Jenna McLaughlin on NPR's Sources and Methods podcast. Jenna, you're bringing us fresh reporting on cyber attacks, alleged cyber attacks by Iran on U.S. infrastructure. What do we know?
Yes, there's still a lot we don't know. So I'll preface with that. But essentially what we do know is that the FBI has revealed that there are at least seven states where we've seen attacks on the water sector. So water, wastewater, public utilities.
Okay.
There's 50,000 of these across the United States. So
utilities, 50,000.
50,000 water facilities.
Okay.
So we could hear of a lot more down the line, but that's what we know so far. So what happened at these water facilities is there were cyber attacks on what are called programmable logic controllers, basically a fancy term for a simple machine in industrial systems that monitors and controls things that those machines do. So in water, it's going to keep track of levels, pressure, etc., and it might control that pressure. So these hackers targeted those systems, and in some cases, they locked people out of their connection to the water pumps. They caused some flooding. They caused some changes in pressure. And that immediately inspired a fair amount of panic in these local communities that, oh no, what's happening with our systems?
You said at least seven states that we know of. Mm-hmm. And I was starting to look, I saw reports, Georgia, New Jersey, Minnesota.
Yes.
So this is like all over. It's not one particular part.
Minnesota
was
the first to come out and talk about this. They've been really transparent. I actually spoke to the mayor of Brom, Minnesota, Nate George, and he has been really transparent about this. He's talked a lot about sort of when he first learned that this was going on.
When did he first? Like, what's the timeline on this?
He said around Monday morning, I think that was the 28th, the 27th or the 28th.
Of July.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And the attacks took place over the weekend in the middle of the night. That's when he first learned about it. And his teams took a couple of hours. They put out an advisory and said, hey, everybody, please conserve water while we figure out what's happening. We've got the backups in our water tank. We're going to be fine. But, you know, something wrong happened here and we're going to investigate it. So they managed to get those systems back online pretty quickly.
So, stay with that, with the do not panic piece of this podcast. As far as we know, no like issues with water quality. Nobody's been hurt by this. It's an issue of trying to figure out something happened. What happened?
Correct. Okay. Yeah, there's no reason to panic that the well has been poisoned.
Right.
Actually, in conversations with a lot of these water operators, there's only so much you can do remotely. You can mess with the levels, the pressure. You can adjust the levels of chlorine, maybe. But there's not a lot you can do unless you're physically on site. So people don't have to panic about that.
Okay. To the who, we said the thinking is this is Iran, that the FBI is thinking this is Iran. Like, tell me more in terms of attribution.
Yeah. So my reporting right now indicates I have one anonymous source who requested anonymity to speak about sensitive issues. And they said that there is some intelligence indicating that this is connected to the IRGC. So the Iranian
Revolutionary Guard Corps.
Okay. Exactly. However, I also spoke with Rob Lee. He's the CEO and co-founder of Dragos, which is, you know, one of the biggest names in the game as far as industrial cybersecurity. He essentially told me that this is still ongoing, but from what he can see, there's a little bit of hesitation to immediately attribute this, and Dragos doesn't do attribution, but there's hesitation in the community to definitively say that this is Iran because no one's actually taken credit for it yet, which is kind of weird. There's still that possibility that it's another actor who's trying to take advantage of the tension between the U.S. and Iran to drum up this fear and concern.
Would this square with what we know Iran's cyber capabilities and ambitions to be?
Yes. So Iranian actors have for several years been trying to find vulnerable systems, particularly in industrial controls in U.S. critical infrastructure, to sort of mess around with them. Low-level stuff, not super sophisticated. You know, they might get in, they might log somebody out of their system, they might deface the display. They've done that before. I think that was with the Unitronic systems. There was another incident in Aliquippa, Pennsylvania. So they have a history of this behavior. But I think as far as actually, you know, wiping out the power, the water, et cetera, that is not something that Iran is capable of. They also have a history of exaggerating their impact, saying, we've reached and touched the great Satan and we've influenced their water and that was a big win and we're so powerful, you know.
Go to the why, Jenna. We're at war with Iran. So, you know, if Iran can't shoot a missile that can reach all the way to, I don't know, D.C., L.A., New Orleans, wherever, this is a way of hitting us.
Certainly. I think they maybe wouldn't want to do that because the U.S. can certainly respond with force. But I talked to Michael Crean. He's the cybersecurity expert at SonicWall. And he said that these kinds of attacks can create fear, whether we're in the middle of an active war or it's a peacetime.
What is it that you can do to potentially, quote unquote, scare the American people? Well, water is one of those things. It's a necessity of life.
So I think that puts it pretty well. You want to create panic, essentially.
That was NPR cybersecurity correspondent Jenna McLaughlin. We were speaking on our national security podcast, Sources and Methods. You can hear our full conversation wherever you get your podcasts.
So far, since President Trump returned to office, ICE has arrested more than 600,000 people. And last month, arrests by ICE reached a record high of 1,400 per day. The agency is leaning on tactics that it used earlier this year in West Virginia. NPR's Sergio Martinez Beltran reports on Operation Country Roads.
Last winter, Stacy Tai was struggling through an illness. Visits from her friend Mohammed Ghezoui kept her going.
Mo came by every day to check. Hey, you need anything? Can I do anything to help? He wanted to support me through that illness. And then, you know, he got taken.
Mo, as she calls him, was born in Algeria and moved to the U.S. after marrying an American citizen. That marriage fell apart, leaving Mo stranded in Appalachia with few connections until he met Stacy at karaoke. Late last year, Mo was working his shift at the King Kebab down the street from her house when three masked ICE officers came in and took him away. He was eventually deported.
Mo was probably one of the first people to get detained, and then the balls just started rolling.
More and more immigrants started getting detained in West Virginia. DHS, then still run by Kristi Noem, launched an enforcement search in the red state that eventually picked up around 600 people. The agency dubbed it Operation Country Roads after the John Denver anthem.
Take me home to the place.
Those proud lyrics sound twisted now to Ty.
It's insulting because Country Roads song is a welcoming song. It's the place I belong. And they're kicking people out.
Operation Country Roads went mostly under the radar, partially because it happened during the much more violent and publicized Operation Metro search in Minneapolis, and because it relied much more on local law enforcement to carry out the arrests. DHS did not respond directly to questions about the West Virginia operation, but current DHS Secretary Mark Wayne Mullen endorsed this tactic at his Senate confirmation hearing.
My goal in 6 months is that we're not in the lead story every single day. My goal is for people to understand we're out there, we're protecting them, and we're working with them.
This tactic and partnership with local law enforcement have been successful, according to data from DHS. In July, ICE daily arrests reached a record high of 1,400 nationally. Now, that doesn't mean all of those arrested will be deported. And this is where we look again at West Virginia, where many of these proceedings are falling apart in court. Cal Voss with the ACLU of West Virginia says attorneys have been challenging detentions through a key legal resource.
We're seeing really successful habeas petition filings. Sometimes people are being released the same day that they're picked up by ICE.
The federal courts in West Virginia have also pushed back. Four judges there have become a big hurdle for Trump's plans. They have called the administration's tactics wrong and, quote, an assault on the constitutional order.
Hi. Are you by chance here for the immigration hearing?
On a windy day in Clarksburg, dozens of people are trying to get into the federal courthouse.
Well, let's go in and see if we can actually do anything.
Most, if not all of them, are here to show support for Eric Cristal Gumez, a man who came to the U.S. illegally and was detained on his job at a popular Mexican restaurant. His U.S. citizen wife, Lauren Cristal, is inside the courtroom, stoic, holding a tissue in one hand, hoping to catch a glimpse of her husband, who is attending via video call from a detention center in a different state.
I think part of you always wants to believe it's not going to happen to you, too, you know. Not me, not my husband.
I talked to Lauren outside right after the hearing. Eric was not released that day.
This is real pain that I'm going through and that many other people are going through.
Life will not return to normal for the newlyweds. Just before airing this story, we got in touch with Lauren again. Eric's asylum application was denied. He decided not to appeal the decision. Instead, he's awaiting a date for his deportation. Sergio Martinez Beltran, NPR News, West Virginia.
You're listening to All Things Considered.
Thanks for listening to KAXC and All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. In just a moment, our daily dose of phenology. Great Tales Animal Rescue hosts adoption events on the second Saturday of each month. That would be this Saturday from 10 to 11 at their shelter located between Grand Rapids and Cohasset. You can also visit the shelter every Tuesday and Saturday 9 to noon to meet adoptable animals or drop off donations. Learn more at greattalesanimalrescue.com. Here's John Latimer.
On today's date, August 6th, in the year 2013, a horse chestnut that I have been observing for many, many years along the River Road has just begun to take on the first blush of fall. Yeah, I know, it seems awfully early for signs of fall, But the horse chestnut is one of those trees that likes to get all the color it can as quickly as it can. It begins with a light blush of red, and it will continue to heighten that color until finally the whole tree looks like an apple. And it looks like an apple because the architecture of the horse chestnut is a rather rounded shape. They don't grow up in a vertical fashion. They tend to grow out in a nice, evenly rounded shape. And so as they progress along into the fall, you will see these bright red, and some turn yellow. Some are yellow and some are red, but they become these large globular color balls that heighten fall.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Procter & Gamble, maker of Metamucil, made with psyllium, a plant-based fiber that helps support digestive health by trapping and removing waste, designed to be taken every day. Learn more at metamucil.com. And from Schwab, offering the Schwab Teen Investor Account, where teens can gain hands-on investing experience. It's co-owned by parents and teens, so parents can monitor the account while teens learn how to invest. More at schwab.com.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. It's time now for our Science News Roundup from Shortwave. That is NPR's science podcast. I'm joined today by Regina Barber and Burley McCoy from the show. Hi, you two.
Hi.
Hello.
As always, y'all have brought us three science stories that caught your attention recently. What do you have in store for us?
So we have one story indicating that people might not be as good at detecting AI content as we think we are.
Plus another about a new wandering supermassive black hole.
And lastly, how pumas can make roads safer for humans.
Let's take them in order. Start with AI and how we are lousy at detecting it. What kind of AI content are we talking here?
So we're talking short stories. So this paper that was recently published in the journal Judgment and Decision Making included a few experiments. In the first one, participants read one of several short stories, some written by people, some of them AI generated. Then they rated them. But here's the catch. Participants were either correctly or incorrectly told that their story was written by a human or AI.
Oh my, I feel like I would be great at this. I want to do it.
Oh, I would be terrible at it.
Burley?
Who knows? Everything's an experiment. In the other experiments that these researchers did, participants got a pair of stories. One was human written and one was AI generated, and they were asked to identify which was which. And these researchers found some key things. First, most participants couldn't tell which stories were AI generated and which were human written. And second, they tended to prefer AI stories, especially if they thought those AI stories were written by humans.
Okay, so what people said they preferred, human writing, and what they actually preferred was often different?
Yeah. So this fits with a growing body of research suggesting that people's beliefs about AI involvement in a message influences how they feel about that message.
Expectation bias.
Exactly. So Dina Weisberg says that it's a sign that large language models have gotten a lot better over the past few years.
I personally feel confident in saying that the time has passed when it is simple to just be able to tell what a human has written and what an AI has written.
Dina's an associate professor of psychological and brain sciences at Villanova University and the senior author of this study.
And now she did caveat that these results might be because of the length of these stories. So they were all around 1,000 words each. And when we talked to some other experts in the field who have done similar research, they emphasized that length is often a key factor in our being able to detect AI-generated content. We also talked to Mohit Iyer, an assistant computer science professor at the University of Maryland. And he wasn't involved in the study, but he told us that because AI-generated content tends to be pretty formulaic, the longer they are, the worse their quality is.
AI got nothing on Tolstoy. Okay, but
no, right.
Go back to the study because I'm trying to figure out why. Like, why do people prefer AI-generated content?
Yeah, Dina had this hypothesis.
The AI-written stories were very obvious and I think more predictable in their flow, which isn't surprising given how AI generates text. And the human written stories were more difficult to read. They were more subtle. They didn't spoon feed you the themes in quite the same way.
So in that way, they're easier stories to read.
Topic two. Okay, so brilliant, Gina. You said topic two is wandering supermassive black holes. What even is that?
Yeah, so supermassive black holes are these objects in space that are millions of times more massive than our sun. And all the ones except for two that have been found are in the center of galaxies, hence wandering. This is one of those two.
Okay, but don't worry, Mary Louise. This wandering black hole is 750 million light years away from us.
Okay, so we got a little bit of time, but if it's that far away,
yeah.
How did they find it?
It ate a star.
It ate a star?
Yeah.
Poor star.
Yeah.
And now I'm nervous again.
No, don't be. It's fascinating, really, because it's most likely not really like wandering, like you say. It's not going to come towards us. It's really probably orbiting a very, very far away galaxy. Usually black holes are invisible unless they're feeding on something. So the way scientists detected this one was by observing a flash of light created when the black hole ripped apart and ate a star.
It's like this little black hole holds up a flashlight. And it's like, here I am, look at me.
So that's Jillian Rustinashad, an author on the paper that came out in the Astrophysical Journal Letters about this black hole. And her colleague, Robert Stein at the University of Maryland, trained an algorithm to recognize the pattern of these special light signatures that indicate that a supermassive black hole ate a star.
They are very rare, but we started to find them in the centers of galaxies. And what we did was we trained the AI algorithm to recognize this very characteristic pattern of light.
Regina, stay with that point he just made, that these are very rare. Why have scientists only found two of these black holes wandering,
and
I'm using air quotes, outside galaxies?
Yeah, so that flash of light is rare, but on top of that, we were only looking for those flashes of light in the center of galaxies. And it kind of blew my mind that astrophysicists, we never thought to look at anywhere else until Yale theoretical astrophysicist Premvada Natarajan and her team proposed the possibility of wandering supermassive black holes and how to find them with this like special light signature. And she says this discovery is a huge leap forward to learning more about black holes, which are still pretty mysterious.
But it looks super exciting, right? So you could find dozens and dozens per year. That's our prediction.
Let me drag us back to Earth.
Yeah.
Topic three, which is how pumas could make roads safer for human drivers. And we should say a puma, that's what? It's a mountain lion, right?
Yeah. Right. Or they're called cougars sometimes too.
Okay.
So here, the researchers looked at puma movement in the Olympic Peninsula in Washington State, and they found where these big cats were most active, the number of vehicle deer collisions were 76% lower than in areas where pumas were least active.
76% lower. That's huge. Okay. Vehicle deer collision, 76% lower. Is that because why? Because pumas are eating the deer? There's fewer to hit.
So I thought that too, but it's not that. So researchers controlled for deer numbers and still found this huge difference in collisions. And the team says it's because the pumas are likely changing deer behavior, both by prompting deer to be more active during the daytime, which makes them more visible to people driving versus in the nighttime, and by pushing them to more remote places away from roads.
That's interesting. Why are pumas pushing them away from roads?
So the researchers think it's because roads break up the landscape and make for really effective hunting grounds for pumas. So think about like a road by a forest. The road is essentially a place the deer would be out in the open. Meanwhile, a puma could be hiding in the forest waiting to ambush them. So the deer avoid it, opting for more secluded areas. And this study was recently published in the journal Current Biology.
I'm thinking about applications. I'm guessing y'all are not about to tell me we should just release a bunch of mountain lions to make our roads safer.
Yeah, not quite yet, or maybe ever. But lead author Justin Sirachi from Conservation Science Partners said it could add to the conversation some people are having in places where pumas are starting to come back naturally.
And, you know, one response to that could be, it's a predator, get it out of here. But another response could be to allow that natural recolonization to occur. And I think this at least provides an argument in favor of that.
Otherwise, pumas coming back could be a hard sell to folks who may be worried about safety or hunting competitors.
Fascinating. All right. We've been speaking with Burley McCoy and Regina Barber from our science podcast, Shortwave. Thanks, you two.
Thank you.
Thanks.
This is NPR News.
Ted Lasso, the show about an American football coach hired to manage an English soccer team, is back for a fourth season. Hannah Waddingham plays the team's owner, who lures Ted back across the pond to coach a new women's team.
We've been passively indoctrinated generationally that women are less than, for sure.
How Ted Lasso tackles women's sports, tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News.
It is 4:29. Thanks for listening to KAXE and All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up in a moment, National Native News. 1 hour from now, it's the Up North Report, local news from our region. Weather for tonight, mostly clear, lows 59 to 63, south winds 5 to 10, gusting higher, and a slight chance of showers and thunderstorms. Sunny tomorrow, highs 75 to 79, northwest wind gusting up to 20. Lows tomorrow night in the low 50s, and for Saturday, mostly sunny, highs in the mid-70s to low 80s. Support comes from the Lake Country Journal, a lifestyle magazine since 1997, a local publication sharing stories from the heart of Minnesota about the places to go, things to do, and people to know in Lake Country. LakeCountryJournal.com. Relationship Safety Alliance invites you to a family fun day, Sunday, August 9th, 11 to 2 at Gregory Park in Brainerd. Enjoy games, prizes, and food.
This is National Native News. I'm Jill Freitas. The power of a powwow has been described as a collective heartbeat that draws people together. Celebrants often say they feel unity and freedom as they dance in a circle. Those elements are especially vital for those serving time at the Oregon State Correctional Institution in Salem. But as Brian Bull of Underscore Native News and KLCC reports, for one day each year, inmates get to move to the rhythm of a rawhide drum with friends and loved ones. A warning, the story contains mentions of violent crime, suicide, and terminal illness.
A soft breeze rustles the frills on Anthony Salazar's regalia. He describes its colors as his wife Stephanie helps with final adjustments.
Colors of white, black, red, and yellow, which is the colors of the four directions. All the regalia is connected to nature somehow.
Drummers gather in a circle while other dancers fix their bangles and beadwork. A man with a microphone greets the crowd of visitors with a smile.
We're so glad that you guys were able to make it. We are about to prepare to do our grand entry.
At first, you'd think this was just any other powwow getting underway. However,
I'm in here for two counts of murder, and I got life sentence. I've been in 24 years.
Salazar, like everyone else preparing to dance or drum, is a lifer at this medium security all-men's prison. An Apache Indian from San Bernardino, he's thrilled to be part of the powwow and that his wife is here.
This is actually the first powwow where I've actually dressed up in regalia and I'm going to dance.
This is my first one that I've been able to come to. Very fortunate to be here. It means a lot.
As dancers gather for the grand entry, a red-tailed hawk soars above. It's a simple but powerful symbol of freedom in a place where guard towers and checkpoints remind everyone this is a prison. MC Sean Jeffers Monroe says it's great having his wife and other loved ones here once a year.
My mother was dying of cancer 3 years ago, and I was able to have this ceremony with her and these last rites and be able to say goodbye to her. So this is that one time a year that we get to be together as a community, as a family, and kind of be free in a way.
One of the guests for this powwow is Aliza Kaplan, a professor at Lewis and Clark Law School in Portland. She says she and some of her students have been invited to this event about five times.
Because we aim to really get to know our clients and what matters to them and see them as more than people who have committed crimes.
No one here glosses over the fact that they're behind bars for serious crimes and may not ever step foot beyond the prison gates. But many see the powwow as a way to hold on to tradition and find worth, says inmate Nestor Diaz Miller with the Cow Creek Band of Umpqua.
I've dealt with suicidal thoughts and actions in my past, and being able to focus on this neepee, on this sweat lodge, and that drum literally saved my life. It's given me something to believe in, something to hope in.
For National Native News, I'm Brian Bull at the Oregon State Correctional Institution in Salem.
The Senate Committee on Indian Affairs is advancing several bills aimed at settling tribal water rights and funding water infrastructure across the West. During a legislative hearing last week, senators considered measures affecting the Yavapai Apache Nation of Arizona, the Agua Caliente Band of Cahuilla Indians, and the Pechanga Band of Luiseno Indians in California, along with legislation to strengthen the Federal Indian Water Rights Settlement Completion Fund. Supporters say the bills would help fulfill the federal government's trust responsibilities while providing greater certainty for tribal nations and neighboring communities. The measures now await further action by the committee and Congress. I'm Jill Freitas.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
The Indian Arts and Crafts Board promotes Indian artists of federally recognized tribes through its online source directory. Information on this no-charge opportunity available at doi.gov/IACB. Who support this program?
Hear that? Tribal college faculty do so much, one can't say it all here. Nothing but respect. Visit mosttheroughjobdescription.com. The American Indian College Fund supports this program.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
com/NPR. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. The Trump administration wants to make significant changes to Head Start. That's the country's early education and child care program for low-income families. Now, this program serves more than 700,000 kids each year from birth to age five in both urban centers and rural areas. Advocates and educators are worried that the proposed loosening of standards will undermine the program. NPR Sequoia Carrillo is following this story and joins us now at NPR West. Hi, Sequoia.
Hi, Elsa.
Hi. Okay, so many families depend on the Head Start program. What are some of the proposed changes that were announced today?
So this new proposal really focuses on two areas, deregulation and in turn cutting costs. So front and center, we have the Trump administration saying they want parents and states to take a larger role in the program. Standards like how many toddlers or babies can one teacher handle on their own, or what kind of training teachers have to work with these little kids, those decisions would be up to the states.
Okay.
They're also saying parents are children's primary teachers and want to bring more parent opinions into the classroom. All of this really amounts to taking a national benchmark for early child care and education and removing it. The new proposal wants to move away from federal mandates, and advocates are worried about it.
But wait, you mentioned cost-cutting measures. What would that mean exactly?
Yes. So right now, Head Start centers can use up to 15% of their budgets to cover administrative costs. The new proposal caps that at 5%. Currently, that money is used for typical daily operations, but it can also do things like reward teachers for getting a degree, and that would no longer be allowed. Yvette Sanchez-Fuentes with Start Early, an Illinois-based Head Start partner, says this approach could also directly impact kids.
If you, for example, have children with disabilities, you could use some of those funds in order to pay for additional staff with specialties who could come in and support kids.
Losing that money could cut support staff and create gaps in care.
Okay, but explain this to me. What is the Trump administration ultimately trying to achieve with all of these changes to Head Start?
It's a great question. So Alex Adams, the Department of Health and Human Services Assistant Secretary, who oversees the whole program, estimates that these changes could save the government $2.2 billion.
Okay.
He says he plans to invest that money back in the program and in turn create 200,000 more spots for children. I relayed that plan to a few different advocates, and they all said similar things. An additional $2 billion for Head Start would be great, but they don't quite see how eliminating all those regulations can get them there.
Mm.
One thing to note is this is a very lengthy proposal. It's about 200 pages, and sometimes reporters and stakeholders get these things early to comb through. This time, we did not. So there's still a lot to sift through, and for now, I think advocates are just ready to dive in and are looking forward to the next steps.
And what are those next steps? Like, will Head Start centers feel these changes right away?
Well, first of all, Head Start centers are still very much open, and all of them are operating under the same rules. But right now, we're heading into a 60-day period for public comment on these new rules. Anyone can submit a comment. Parents, advocacy groups, concerned citizens. The groups I spoke with are really hoping for tons of comments. That would mean it would take a long time to go through them. And the final rules might look different than what we have right now, or they might not change at all. Either way, we won't really know for a few months.
That is NPR's Sequoia Carrillo. Thank you so much, Sequoia.
Thank you.
This week in the Iraqi city of Karbala, the annual commemoration unfolded of the 7th century killing of the central figure in Shia Islam. More than 20 million pilgrims, including more than 3 million Iranians. This year, with the U.S. war in Iran, the event carried even more significance, as NPR's Gina Raff reports.
In 1,400 years, mourning over the death of Imam Hussein has not diminished. It wasn't an ordinary death. Hussein, the grandson of the Prophet Muhammad, was surrounded by a powerful army, deprived of water, and then beheaded after opposing a leader he believed was unfit to succeed the Prophet. It was the defining event of the split between Shia and Sunni Islam. Inside the shrine, pilgrims press against the gold and silver encrusted latticework around the spot where he died, many hitting themselves in grief. Voices rise and fall, different accents, different languages, the same lament. Outside, there are young men holding an Iranian and Iraqi flag linked together. Some carry photos of Iran's late supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, killed on the first day of U.S. and Israeli airstrikes, along with his family, in February.
116 degrees on the thermometer. But the heat hits you in waves. There's a burning wind coming in, and it just feels even hotter. In between the shrines, there's a covered walkway, and every so often, fans are spraying cooling mists of water. But this is still grueling. And imagine, after walking here for days, like many of these pilgrims have,
Mariam Ghanbari, a municipal worker, walked from the Iranian border about 200 miles away. She tells us many pilgrims have come this year because people are praying for vengeance for the killing of Khamenei. Most Iranians on pilgrimage here are fervent supporters of the country's Islamic regime. Those who are anti-regime are not talking. Nasser Zadi, a teacher from Tabriz, says Khamenei's killing has only increased support for resistance against the U.S. and Israel.
It helped this movement become deeper and more targeted. It's helped us flaunt the power of the Shia more to the face of the world, to show that the Shia are building their own civilization.
He says Iranians have learned to deal with the economic hardship of the war. This is the culture of resistance, he says. Mohammed Yasmin Ahmadi is 15 and from the Iranian holy city of Qom. He says most Iranians are here this year because of Khamenei. Before he was buried in July, the supreme leader's body was first taken to Karbala and Najaf. This Arbaeen has the scent and the feeling of the Ayatollah, the teenager says. The Iranians we talk to stress they have nothing against the American people, that they believe that Americans too are suffering from U.S. policy. They say this time it is the U.S. government and not an army 1,400 years ago waging war on the Shia. Jane Araf, NPR News, Karbala, Iraq. Listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
You're listening to KAXE and All Things Considered. It is 4:44. I'm Jennifer Barr. In a moment, North Star Stories produced by Ampers, news from throughout the state of Minnesota. Support comes from the First State Bank of Big Fork with branches in Big Fork and Kellyer, offering tools for managing money on any mobile device. Hometown banking at its best since 1912. FSBBigFork.com, member FDIC. Watermark Arts Center in Bemidji hosts works by Monica Erke beginning this Friday with a reception from 5 to 7. Erke's exhibit studies the invasive plants of Minnesota in a series of lino cut prints. Erke will give demonstrations on her work on Saturday at 10 a.m. And Grand Rapids Players present Sir Valorant and the Dragon Friday, August 7th, 7 o'clock outside the Soo Line Depot in Reamer. Bring your own chair for this free show. Let us know what's happening in your community. Email us, psa@kaxe.org.
You are listening to North Star Stories, voices from where we live, a daily newscast about what it means to live in Minnesota.
With headlines from around the state, I'm Zan Holston.
The same luxury that's been afforded to us for over 100 years, I hope can still remain for all types of worshiping folks.
Lakeville pastor Nathan Like is among the interfaith supporters of what will become the South Metro City's second mosque. The city council has unanimously approved a permit for the Al Hadi Islamic community, which has rented space in a school district building since 2020. One Lakeville student says a permanent home would give children more than just a place for religious worship.
When some people hear the word mosque, they think it's only a place where Muslims pray. But for kids like me, it's much more than that. It's where we learn to respect our parents, teachers, and neighbors. It's where we organize food drives and volunteer activities.
Al Hadi leaders say the mosque could be open within about a year. The federal government now owns a long-vacant prison in western Minnesota, just one day after ICE announced a five-year detention center contract. CoreCivic, the country's largest private for-profit prison company, sold the 1,600-bed Prairie Correctional Facility in Appleton to Homeland Security for nearly $500 million. CoreCivic will continue operating the facility for the next 5 years. Detainees will start arriving later this year. The closure of a Silver Bay clinic is raising new concerns about access to care along the North Shore. Aspirus Lakeview will close its Silver Bay clinic at the end of the year, citing staffing shortages and changes in how healthcare is performed. It will move its appointments, labs, and x-rays to Two Harbors. The closure will create a gap in patient care that community healthcare expert Sam Usum says will force sick people to travel much farther.
You know, those who live in Silver Bay are going to have to go 30 miles farther to Two Harbors for care. Well, those who were already 30 miles, now they're going 60 miles for care.
Meanwhile, North Shore Health in Grand Marais is seeking nearly $1.5 million in federal rural health money to upgrade technology and expand telehealth, virtual emergency care, and behavioral health services. Four candidates for governor faced questions in Farm County at the annual Farm Fest near Morgan in southwestern Minnesota. When asked how they would stop fraud in state programs, Republican Mike Lindell proposed a business-style review, while DFL U.S. Senator Amy Klobuchar pointed to her prosecutorial experience.
We're going to dig into every single program.
The minute I get in there, I will launch a top-to-bottom audit of state government.
With Minnesota's primary coming Tuesday, GOP-endorsed Kendall Qualls said lawmakers' votes on spending should be easier to trace, while Republican House Speaker Lisa Daymuth said lawmakers need dedicated fraud oversight.
No more mega spending bills, one single bill item at a time, so we can have clear accountability.
As Speaker of the House, I established the Fraud Prevention and Agency Oversight Committee.
The forum put rural costs, markets, healthcare, and government accountability at the center of the governor's race. FarmFest continues through today. Across Minnesota, farmers are meeting customers face-to-face during National and State Farmers Market Week. Minnesota and tribal nations have more than 400 farmers markets where farmers sell directly to their neighbors. The state agriculture department plans special events at markets around the state, including Sauk Rapids in New Ulm today. Ada is tomorrow evening in Rochester Saturday, among others. Details are on the state agriculture department's website. A federal ban could remove most hemp-derived THC drinks and edibles from Minnesota stores this fall, but the U.S. Senate may throw the state industry a lifeline. Congress passed the ban last year, saying the federal hemp law left intoxicating hemp products with too few safeguards. But a must-pass funding measure currently moving through Congress would push the November deadline to December while lawmakers try to find a longer-term fix. The funding bill still needs final Senate approval. And finally, a Twin Cities entrepreneur who grew up in rental housing is now using his fortune to help other families stay in their homes by helping pay the rent. John Wilson made his money through New Brighton-based Wilson Wolf, which makes devices used in cancer treatments. He initially pledged $16 million after Operation Metro Surge. But his Wilson Foundation has provided about $29 million in rent assistance so far, roughly 20,000 payments, and he plans to give at least 5 million more. For North Star Stories, I'm Zan Holston.
North Star Stories is produced by Amherst, Minnesota's community radio stations, with support from the state of Minnesota, online at amherst.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly, and it is August. For a lot of kids across the country, that means summer camp. According to the National Study of Youth and Religion, nearly 40% of American teenagers have attended camps with some religious affiliation. Christianity has been part of summer camps since camping started. Jewish camps followed later, but only a handful of American summer camps are Buddhist. Reporter Dina Prichep spent the day at one of them.
Dharma Camp is in the foothills of Oregon's Cascade Mountains, an hour outside of Portland. In some ways, it's like every other sleepaway camp. Swimming hole, friendship bracelets, dusty fields. But there's also a meditation service in the Zen tradition. Campers actually spend the entire morning in silence, quietly doing chores, eating a wordless breakfast. The only real noise comes when they chant a Buddhist sutra of compassion. If you think teens and tweens might kind of struggle to start their day in silent reflection, you would not be wrong.
Honestly, my first day at camp, I'm always like, oof, I have to sit for 20 minutes. But it kind of grows on you, you know.
Cyrus Boyd is 16, one of the older campers. For the youngest, like 10-year-old Isabel Bryce, the quiet morning can be even more challenging.
You just want to talk and talk and talk. Like, you just want to talk about your dreams and like, oh, I saw a flying chameleon. Oh, I saw a flying whale.
It's not easy. But a lot of the kids come to really get something out of it. Like 12-year-old Evie Phillips.
I'm definitely going to meditate like a lot more after this because like it just calms you down and stuff.
Dharma Camp started over 30 years ago. Kakumyo Lo is the abbot at Portland's Dharma Rain Zen Center and is here for his 27th summer.
This is a fairly like low church environment, so to speak, but we have monks here. We have priests here. You know, we're wearing robes for service. It's just kind of sprinkled throughout the entire day, and most of it is summer camp. Most of it feels like playtime.
But even that play is shaped by Buddhist practice, like their version of color war, where each team is competing on behalf of a particular enlightened figure from the Buddhist lineage.
Welcome to the Bodhisattva Olympics!
As the counselors explain, these games are not about trouncing the other team.
We're watching how you work together. If you're cooperating, if you're being kind, if you're staying calm.
One event involves a sort of live-action version of Hungry Hungry Hippos, where kids on scooters snag plastic eggs and then use the words hidden inside to craft haiku about Dharma Camp.
Trust your history. Even beyond death, it is steady from deception.
Wow!
It's creative and silly, but also Buddhist. This camp is a way to instill religious practice and values, which faith-based camps have been doing since summer camp began. Jacob Sorensen is the director and lead researcher at Sacred Playgrounds, an organization that works with Christian summer camps.
It immerses them in a really faith-centric environment. So that gives that opportunity to consider the question, hey, do I really believe this stuff? Do I really believe this faith that I was raised in?
Sorensen says that at a time when religious identity is on the decline, data suggests that faith-based camps, of any faith, may make an impact. But not all Dharma camp parents are Buddhist. And even some that are, like Conan Clark, say religious identity is not really the goal for their kids.
It's not so much that I necessarily want him to become a Buddhist as that I want him to have that experience of being around people whose hearts are open, who have a practice of coming back to compassion.
Dharma camp seems to be doing a surprisingly good job of translating that compassion into a daily summer camp schedule. It's a mix of mindfulness and playfulness and religious practice.
Every year when I leave Dharma camp, my mom tells me I have this glow.
19-year-old Violet O'Haron has gone from camper to counselor.
Like, I have this profound sense of self that I always find here and then can take with me wherever else I go.
Evenings at Dharma camp end around a campfire. The occasional eagle flies by, the sun goes down, and the stars and guitars come out. One of the Buddha's core teachings is that everything is impermanent. Campers here have been learning the Zen practice of being still in the middle of all that flux and listening to what's true. That fires will go out, summer will end, and these kids will become adults. And maybe they'll take a piece of this camp with them. For NPR News, I'm Dina Pritchip.
This week, the Billboard Hot 100 singles chart is dominated by country music crossovers. Stephen Thompson of NPR Music brings us the details.
The biggest hit of 2026, by a wide margin, is a country song, namely Ella Langley's chart topper, Choosin' Texas.
He's choosin' Texas, I can tell.
This week, the song spends a 16th week at number one on the Billboard Hot 100. That's a run matched or exceeded by only six other songs in Billboard history. This week, the charts capture a larger milestone for country music. For the first time, the entire top five is made up of country songs. Morgan Wallen enters this week's chart at number two with his new single, Been By Now. If it was meant to be, we'd have been by now. We wouldn't have to keep trying to work things out. Yeah, baby, we're a freeze when the lights go down. It wouldn't be so hard when we ain't in the dark. Taylor Swift returned to her country roots in a song she wrote for the movie Toy Story 5. This week, I Knew It, I Knew You dips to number three. And maybe the charts aren't giving you enough Ella Langley or Morgan Wallen. If that's the case, you'll be glad to know that at number four, I Can't Love You Anymore is by Ella Langley and Morgan Wallen.
No, I can't love you anymore. Anymore. No, I can't love you.
Finally, the song at number five belongs to a fresh face, the singer Stella Lefty. Her breakthrough single, Boston, has been blowing up all summer. Next week, a new album by the pop star Ariana Grande promises to at least challenge the songs at the top. But for now, the pop charts are firmly in the grip of hot country summer. Stephen Thompson, NPR Music.
Thank you for listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Workday, an enterprise AI platform for HR, finance, and IT.
dedicated to providing precision and the ability to not just help get work done, but get it done right. It's a new work day. From the Pew Charitable Trusts, sharing real stories with supporting data through its podcast, After the Fact, exploring how people find solutions to some of today's biggest issues. From Progressive, Progressive Commercial Auto Insurance protects the vehicles that work to keep small businesses moving forward, including protection while running errands and other tasks at progressivecommercial.com. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
It's just before 5 o'clock. Thank you for listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley, Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker. We're celebrating 50 years of people-powered radio in northern Minnesota. You can join us at KAXE.org. I'm Jennifer Barr. Stay tuned for another hour of All Things Considered. We'll have the Up North Report, local news from our region at 5:30. 6 o'clock, As It Happens, news from a Canadian perspective. And 7 o'clock tonight, DJ Lake Poseidon, your volunteer host for On the River, a great mix of music. Mostly clear tonight, lows 59 to 63, south winds 5 to 10, gusting higher, and a slight chance of showers and thunderstorms. Sunny tomorrow, highs in the mid to upper 70s, northwest winds gusting up to 20 miles per hour. And for Saturday, mostly sunny, highs in the mid 70s to low 80s.
A new agreement.